No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will try to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia. Tonight we have a very special guest, Logan Phillips. We're happy to have him on the show to talk about polling and see what's up, because the polls seem to be wrong lately. Logan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Senator, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And, you know, I'm starting a little late here. Anyway, we want to talk about polling tonight. You know, it seems to me that I've said this over and over again on the air, the one good thing about the election of Donald Trump in 2016 for me is that my family no longer asked for my political opinion, because I said there's no way this guy can get elected. Look, there's no way this guy can get elected. And then I said, just look at the polls. He's not going to get elected. So let's start there at the very beginning. What happened in 2016? Do you know?
That's a great question. I'm lucky that I didn't start doing election forecasting until 2020. So I don't have anyone that can test me on my record on that. But I think what happened there is a combination of two things. One, I think we got lulled into a little bit of complacency because we had these forecasts and polling that were just so spot on in back-to-back-to-back cycles that it really began to be something we really believe in. And then second, while the luck ran out, people started to respond to polls a lot less, which made pollsters' jobs a lot harder. And we had a group turnout in a rate we haven't seen before of white, non-college-educated voters, and that was hard for people to predict. And, you know, I think these are the types of problems we're a lot more at risk now for, not only because people are responding to their phones less, and we can get more into that in the future, but also because our politics is so polarized now, along racial lines, along gender lines, around age, education, and religion. And so if you're not doing a good enough job of getting a representative sample of every group and the people that you're talking to, the chance for a huge miss like 2016 and 2020 is just so much higher.
Well, isn't that the critical thing? I remember that from graduate school, where I did a project with the Survey Research Center at the University of Michigan, and everything on polling, the accuracy of all of it revolves around having a random sample, does it not? And being able to get that random sample. Is it harder to get a random sample now?
Oh my gosh, yes. It's much, much, much harder. And the reason is, you know, I think if people just think about it in your own lives, if you get a poll from a stranger and you answer it, even if you're weird like me and you actually like talking to random people on the phone, you start to get kind of pushed out of the practice, because almost every time that happens, it's a spam call. And so now I don't even answer it myself. So, you know, I think Nate Cohen from the New York Times, who does a lot of polls, said that even back in 2016, 1.6% of the dials that his team would do would get answered and they'd complete the survey. Now it's down to 0.4%.
Wow.
Well, and that's just from 2016.
Well, what about that, about the people that you do, in fact, reach? You know, the classic example I remember from college was the election of Harry Truman, his reelection, where the Chicago Tribune printed the headline, Dewey defeats Truman. And that was, considered a classic example of polling era. And I think they decided one of the reasons for that is because they did phone polls. And in those days, you were much more likely to have a phone if you were a Republican than you were if you were a Democrat. So how does that affect you now as you go through, trying to find people on their cell phones and things like that? If you're only reaching young people on their cell phones, and are you going to always find out that Bernie Sanders is the winner or AOC or you know what I mean? How do you get around that problem of actually reaching people? Do you know how they do that?
Yeah, there's a lot more online polls now, and that's really important for reaching young voters or people in general as the response rate goes down for phones. And it helps you figure out, in our polls, we're not getting enough of this demographic. Well, we know these demographics go to this type of website a lot, so we can try to really target them. If you're not, you ask people in the polls, what's your race, what's your gender, education, et cetera. And so that will give you an idea if you're not getting a good enough response rate with certain groups.
Well, there are people that call polling political sophistry, that it's just a justification. We see what we want to see and then we put that out as fact. Is that really what do you think about that, I guess, is my question. Do you think there is some sophistry there that certainly that was the case with the Dewey defeats Truman headline because the Chicago Tribune hated Harry Truman? Do we find what we look to find in polls often?
Yeah, definitely 100%. And sometimes it's not even what people want to see. It's what's in their financial interests. Newspapers got hit very hard for the repeat mistakes of 2016 and 2020, which even though people saw Biden winning, we had polls in Wisconsin on average showing him winning by 8. That was probably the biggest polling miss I've ever seen in the decades that I've looked at work when I was building my election forecast model. So to me, the key is to build polling averages. So when you're looking at all the polls and you're weighing them by how strong the pollsters have been in the past, you're sometimes, like this cycle in particular, aggressively correcting for partisan pollsters' bias. You get a much better overall number. And that's the type of thing that I try to do at racetothewh.com. When we did that, this time around in particular, I think our Senate polling average got every race right but one, even without doing any forecasting work. And that was the Nevada race, which is the one place where Democrats tend to get pretty consistently underrated. And for the governor race, it got all but two races right. Wisconsin, I think it had Tony Evers losing by 0.1%. So that was basically a tie. So we did see it get a lot better this time around. Pollsters seem to work really hard at correcting some of their mistakes from 2020. It did this time underestimate Democrats. But I think the narrative about the polls this time said that Democrats were in deep trouble because they had lost a lot of ground in the last month. But in my opinion, at least going into Election Day, they still were the favorites in the Senate.
Well, the pollsters tend to remind us that polls are just snapshots of a particular moment in time, and they're not predictors of the future. So if that's the case, first of all, do you believe that? And if that's the case, really, what good are they to us if we can't use them to predict the future? If we can only say that 6 days before the election, these people thought this way, but we're not sure what they're going to feel like on Election Day. How useful are polls to us?
I think they're useful for two reasons that are directly built on each other. One, I'm not trying to overpromote myself, but just to explain how my answer gets here. So one of the other things with Race to the White House we do is we predict the results of elections, and polls are a big part of it, but they're not the only thing. You got to take it into the context of how did this senator run 6 years ago the last time they ran? How does the state tend to vote? Who's raising more money? And when you put that in together, you can often predict, 95, 96% of the time is going to win. And the second reason, which is the why does that matter other than just that for people like you and me that really care about the result and want to know what's going on? Well, let's say you're an activist. If you like to volunteer or you like to donate to races, right? we all have only so much time, and everyone works hard for their money. You want to make sure it's going to the places where it's going to make the biggest difference. And looking at election forecasts and also looking at the polling gives you a good read of, okay, this poll could be wrong. This forecast could be wrong. It is always good to have a healthy dose of skepticism, but chances are far higher that if I donate to Raphael Warnock's campaign, it's going to make more of a difference than if I donate to Senator Alex Padilla in California, who has a 99.9% chance, where Warnock maybe has a 55% chance going back into this past election day.
So polls affect our behavior. Is that dangerous for our democracy? I mean, should we be basing our politics on who's got the best chance as opposed to who's got the best platform? I mean, doesn't polling – there's a thing called the bandwagon effect in politics. Of course, political scientists also have a thing called the underdog effect, and they both work in opposite directions. But the bandwagon effect says basically people like to go with a winner. So if a poll says I'm ahead, they're more likely to vote for me. You think that's true? You think we're changing – polls actually change our voting behavior? Or, just like we're not allowed to tell what the election results in California are in a presidential election. I mean, I'm sorry, on the East Coast, what the election results have been, because it might affect voting on the West Coast because there's a 3-hour time difference. Are they affecting our behavior in that way? And should they? I don't want to vote. I'm not going to bother to go out and vote for Joe Biden because I already saw he lost in a couple of key states. I mean, do you think that's a healthy thing for democracy?
I am skeptical, at least specifically for today, when there's such a huge separation in the parties and people are so emotionally invested, that would have an effect in specifically a general election. I think it has an enormous effect in primaries, and I think it's good and bad. It means that some candidates, maybe like Cory Booker last cycle, that people constantly said they really liked, but he was never able really to build up support. Part of that was like people were saying, oh, well, if he starts polling better, he might be my guy. I heard that so many times. And so I think the upside of that is, you know, the way, especially on the Democratic side in these primaries and the presidential level, at least, and I realize, you know, there's a lot of things beyond just the presidential primaries, but it's such a weird system where if candidates don't start really mobilizing support early on, it's snowballing, you're heading to a contested convention. And there's something to be said if they're going to donate, volunteer, or even vote for someone, that you want to make sure your vote goes to one of the people that can win. So perhaps it's less of a, I want to be part of the crowd thing. Maybe that's part of it. But I think more than that, it's that people want to be strategic because they value their vote. And so they want to give it to the person that's a strong contender that can actually win.
Well, and what you just said, actually, I think had a dramatic impact in 2016 with Hillary Clinton. I remember as a political insider inside the party, I'm a superdelegate and have been for the last several conventions. Everybody thought Hillary Clinton had it wrapped up. During the primary season, everybody talked like from day one, like she was the presumptive candidate. And really that was some of the genius of Neil Axelrod, who was Obama's campaign manager, that he, I'm sorry, I'm not talking about 2016. I'm talking about 2008, but he noticed that, you know, that Clinton wasn't addressing the caucuses, and he went out to the Iowa caucuses and the other caucuses, and he won the caucus states, and that started the momentum that you were just talking about. So I think it had a dramatic effect on Obama's nomination, and really caught Clinton by surprise. And actually that may have led to 2016, where a lot of people thought that Bernie Sanders and some of the other candidates were blocked out, and I think in part of the process inside the Democratic Party, in part that was because the Clinton people weren't going to get fooled again, you know, once
yes
Right. They said, no, we're not going to let it happen again. We're not going to let somebody creep in from the side like Obama did. And I really think they felt that, that there was that animosity between the two of them. So I think that had a really a dramatic effect. So if I understand what you're saying, you think that the more polls you have, the better off you are, because that helps you average polls and come up with a consensus. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, look, I am hardly a random person in society in this regard. It is in my interest to do my job well. Whenever that's a public good or not is worthy of debate. But I would still say that, you know, no matter how much polls we have, people are really hard to predict. Polling is harder than it used to be. And I think one of the biggest lessons we from 2016 is to come into every election when you start to feel confident and just go through in your head, what if I'm wrong and what are the reasons I'm going to be wrong? And if you do that, you start to see some. I think one of them in 2016, which is really easy to say in retrospect, right, is to just point to the fact that the only thing harder than being an incumbent president is to win three terms in a row. The only time it's happened since Truman was, you know, the Reagan to the Bush administration. You know, people really like change. People often emphasize, well, you know, Clinton lost to the person with the lowest approval rating going into the election of any president. How could she have messed up the campaign? I mean, the way to look about it is that Donald Trump went up against the person who, not trying to disrespect Clinton, who I do respect, but had the second lowest approval rating after 8 years of a Democratic president, and he barely won. Arguably, she overperformed if you didn't know anything about the polling. Because that's an election Republicans normally would win.
Well, yeah, and isn't that the case right now? I mean, the pundits, and how much do you think that affected the polling? The fact that all the indicators, all the historical indicators were against the Democrats, right? The economy, inflation is high. Gas prices are high. The incumbent party is usually, they usually get the blame for that. And there's a historic change in the House of Representatives, usually against whatever the incumbent party is. But no red wave, which was the thing that was predicted by many, many pollsters, that never materialized. So, you know, is that what happened? Did we expect to see the Republican landslide more based on the historical facts than on the polling itself? And did that affect the polling, do you think?
Yeah, I think the polling was pretty good this year. It did lean a little bit to the left, but I think it was more the analysis of that led us astray, because so my view is all that stuff should be really relevant when we're making a prediction in January of 2022 or January of 2021. By the time we got to Election Day, we had so many other indicators that to me are a lot more reliable, because we knew that voters were really fired up on the D side more than usual. And it was clear from the fundraising and from the polling. We knew that a lot of independent voters were unsettled, you know, probably mostly by Roe, but a lot of other things related to Democratic issues. And we can even see it from the way, you know, Republicans and Democrats are spending their money. You know, Mitch McConnell doesn't like to waste the money that he raises. And he was spending a lot of time spending money in Ohio, way more than he was willing to spend in Arizona. And that kind of told us something too, right? So I think the problem was, In 2016 and 2020, people just got it so wrong, overestimating Republicans. They didn't really want to get it wrong again. They were learning from the historic mistakes or the historic trends as well, but they just overlearned the lesson, which to me is natural human nature. If you're going to, like, if you want to be a little smarter than conventionalism, I think one of the things to look out for is what are people overhyping on and agreeing on because of some recent event. And 9 out of 10 times, in my view, they're going to be overstating how much that should matter going forward.
And how do you judge the salience of an issue? That seemed to me to be a big problem with the polls this time. Is when I looked at the polls, and I don't study polling. I don't look at it the way you do. I'm just telling you what I've seen on CNN and CNBC and Meet the Press. The polls seem to indicate that even though abortion, for example, was a big issue, it was not one of the top issues. The top issues seem to come out in every poll. The top issues seem to come out with the economy as the number one issue. Jobs, the inflation, the cost of gas, these all ranked above abortion. But if the Democrats had a high turnout based on a woman's right to choose, how do you predict that? How do you know the value of that? For example, when you call me on the phone and you say, "Hey, Mike, what's your most important issue?" and I say the economy and and gas prices and so on and so forth, and then I get down to a woman's right to choose. How do you decide how important that is to me? Because if I'm motivated to go out on the basis and vote on a woman's right to choose, but it's not my most important issue, and of course the big, I'm sorry to make this question so convoluted, but the big issue right now that people are talking about is democracy. Right. The president said that Americans stood up to save our democracy. That was what was important to him. But that's not what the polls reflected.
So I would say I would answer this in two parts. I'd say in the first part, how do we know that Roe in particular had salience? And I think we can look at how the polls were getting worse and worse for Democrats over time. I honestly think we were on track for a below average performance in a midterm for Republicans, maybe like an R+4, R+5 popular vote. But, it just dramatically shifted into a real horse race after that. And the timing was just too much of a coincidence because nothing else at that point was a major shift. I think we do know, I'm going to get to the part in the middle in a sec, but to get to the last point you made about do we know democracy mattered? I think we really know it does. Because the whole MAGA Republicans thesis that Biden had advocated for, that not all Republicans, there's a certain kind of Republicans that are anti-democracy and are very dangerous, that's how the voters by and large interpreted it across the country. We saw just about every single Republican that had argued, whenever they were saying it or not, the notion that, hey, it's not the voters that get to decide, it's me that gets to decide because the whole process is rigged, so we're going to change it so we can shift the outcome in the way we want. You know, the Kerry Lakes of the world, the Doug Mastrianos of the world, they just got, their butts handed to them. They lost just about every single competitive race in the country, and often lost by huge margins. I think Mastriano lost by 17. Wisconsin, one of the few places we had a polling miss, and this time it was in favor of them, so it wasn't that dramatic. Republican governor candidate Tim Meckel said that this, when he wins, Republicans will be winning every election from here on forward, and ironically, he didn't. That just really turned off voters. So I think the overperformance shows that. Now, in terms of why we didn't see voters always say abortion was their top issue, I think abortion and democracy, and to some degree, gun control and climate, all tie together in the same sense that for a lot of voters that maybe are recent Democrat voters that voted for Biden in 2020, used to vote for Republicans like the Romney Biden voters, they got kind of turned off. And I think like normally these elections are referendums, but this became a choice election because they got the idea that maybe Republicans can't be trusted with this power, or at least some Republicans can't. And all of this was reinforcing. It's almost like this election became about freedom. And that's not just a woman's right to choose or the right to vote, but it's, do we want to elect people that are going to tell us how we should live our life and try to run things the way they think they should? Mark Kelly said this about Blake Masters about all the time, about this guy is one of those people that thinks he always knows he's right and should be telling you what to do, right? There's just this sense. And America, to me, like every country has something that defines it. To me, for America, it's liberty and the ability to determine your own future, to live the life the way you wanted to, not to be infringed upon by the government or anything else. And that doesn't just help Republicans. And in my view, in this election, that is single-handedly tied across all these different threads what made Democrats do so well. And the Republicans that were not perceived to be making people nervous about those types of things did more than fine. Sometimes they did fantastic, like Mike DeWine in Ohio, although he did have a lot of restrictions on abortion.
Well, I mean, I would point out that hindsight is 20/20, and I think that this is a problem sometimes with pollsters, is that at the end, when we get to the you know, final result, they have a way to interpret what they found out as being correct, whether it was correct or not. But let me ask you the most what I think is the most important question, which is the danger of polling, in that does polling change the message? Did Biden come out with the democracy message because of what Democrats were seeing in the polls? And is that you know, does that affect our democracy, that instead of coming up with a platform that I believe in, I'm going to come up with a platform that you believe in? We're very, very often politicians are criticized for this, right? Is that, you know, they say what you want to hear rather than what they really feel. What do you think about that?
I think in the best version, and, you know, as you know, from a lot more experience than me, there are some politicians that are there for the right reasons, and that's obviously not all. If they're using polling and find it valuable, they look for the message that checks both boxes of something that they deeply believe and connects in their values, that also connects with the American people. And so there's an issue that maybe they have done amazing work on human trafficking, and that's something they champion in their career, but it's not an issue that's connecting with voters. It doesn't mean they don't keep fighting to reduce it, but they might talk about how we can solve homelessness instead, because that's also important to them and that connects with voters. If you're having which obviously happens a lot of the time, I'm not saying it doesn't. If you're having the type of campaign where it's all based off polls, that's not a good thing. I think, though, like, this is an area where I disagreed with most analysts and pollsters for a while, but a lot of incredibly smart people and pollsters were saying, hey, the democracy issue is not rating very high. Why are these people talking about it all the time? Which is kind of annoying, because it's like, well, we just saw our democracy under attack. But I also think that they just were kind of thinking along the lines of, because it's not important today, it won't be important tomorrow. And I would say something Democrats should get a lot of credit for, including Biden, is to say, this is a unique moment in history where if it's not registering as a high concern, we need to do everything in our power to change that, because that's going to be what we need to do to protect the country. And so I think they talked about it all the time. You had the January 6th committees. Biden made it a focal point in his speeches. And some of this seems to be driven, at least from the articles that I've read, by his conversations with historians that convinced them this is the point to really hit upon, and that if you do it right, you might be able to move people. So to me, that was kind of a unique moment of leadership, going against the polls to just mobilize people on what matters. And it seems to have really worked.
First of all, let me tell you, that's a great answer. And you should run for public office, because that was a really good answer to that question. But let me ask you, can you give me any insight about push polling? Now, push polling was a big issue in 2016, it seemed to me, in 2020, but we didn't really hear about it in 2022. Has it fallen out of fashion for some reason, or are people still doing push polls? And for our audience who might not understand what a push poll is, a push poll asks questions that are designed to move people in a particular direction towards a particular candidate. Do we see as much of that going on as we saw in, for example, in 2016 in local races?
So when you say push polls, do you mean that they're hoping the results of the polls will shift the way people cover or maybe vote? Or are you saying that are you talking about polls themselves, like Cheney ran or that Bush ran against,
right,
McCain in 2000?
Right, exactly. The polls that Bush ran against McCain where I ask you a double negative. So no matter how you answer, it makes the other candidate look bad.
Yeah, if their goal is to mobilize the people they talk to in the polls, I think that just doesn't work anymore because the response rate, ironically, the thing that makes polling so hard, the response rate is so low that, like, that's the worst way you could have to just shift people's minds is to pretend to be a pollster because someone's going to talk to you. So that would have worked in 2000. I don't think it would have worked as much now. In terms of, but I do think you see pollsters with an agenda for sure. Trafalgar missed by 7.5 points to the right. This time. It was really annoying, honestly, adding all these Republican pollsters to my average at the end, because I could tell they were probably making my forecast wrong. And I'm just fortunate enough that I adopted the practice of aggressively correcting for bias. Otherwise, I would have had Warnock on track to lose in the first round. And I might have had Mark Kelly in a toss-up in Pennsylvania going red, too, because that stuff can definitely lead you astray. I don't really understand what they get out of that, though. I don't really see why moving a polling average in the last few days or having some polls that are good for one candidate helps you. I get it when you do it 2 months out when you're trying to get more funding.
Yeah, no, I think, as I mentioned earlier about the bandwagon effect, I think maybe that's their hope, is that, you know, is that they can drive more people to the polls if they come out with, a positive, or keep people away from the polls if they come out with a negative. So let me ask you, how about actors in your business, people that pollsters? As I told you before the show started, I worked a couple of weeks for Harris Bowling Company. And when I was first starting in politics 40 years ago, Harris polls were the polls. Those were the polls that everybody listened to. I don't even know if Harris is still around anymore. But we hear places like I don't know why I can't say the name of this university, but Quinnike APAC University, they're a new polling powerhouse, aren't they? I never even heard of them before 2016. Now I see their polls everywhere, and their Clear Politics and other polling companies. It seems like there's been a proliferation of different polling companies over the last 20 years. Is that true? There are a lot more pollsters out there today?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more today than there was at least 18 years ago or 12 years ago. I think there might be less now than there were 8 years ago, because polling's gotten so much more expensive, or at least some of these ones might not make it necessarily. A lot less releasing public polls this time than 2020. But, you know, Quinnipiac is a good pollster. Marist is someone I really trust, and they had a fantastic year. Mm-hmm. And you really do want to look at people's track records to judge them. But I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but I think the key is to follow the average overall. And also, you know, people always rely on Real Clear Politics because it's been an institution that's been there for a long time. I do think we now have better options because they don't weigh the polls and they don't correct for bias. And they also made a really, really big strategic error this time. I think they came into the cycle thinking, well, we just had two giant R polling misses. We're just going to assume that from the get-go. They were incredibly selective at the polls they decided to include or not include. And that meant that their model was overwhelmingly underestimating Democrats, because instead of there being a giant R miss, there was a slight D miss. So that made them miss by like 6 points in a lot of these races. So to me, they're not really following a rigorous data model anymore the way that they used to.
Has predicting from polls become harder because of the changes in voting behavior and the changes in laws, like early voting, mail-in voting, same-day registration? Have these changed voting behavior in such a way that it makes it harder to predict what outcomes will be?
I'm not sure if it hurts polling, but it does mean that we have to be really cautious in terms of reading into the data of how people are voting and looking at the early voting numbers to predict what the total will be, because this is kind of a refrain of mine over the last 2 weeks before the election. Like in 2018, we didn't have the Donald Trump thing about don't do early voting or don't do vote by mail. Like right. In California, they literally set it up to help Arnold Schwarzenegger win re-election. And now Republicans don't touch it in most states because they think it's a rigged process where Democrats don't feel that way at all. But So that has thrown the numbers askew in terms of it's really hard to use that as a base point, also because the rules are changing in a lot of states. And then if we overuse 2020, well, that was, that was a weird election when everyone was worried about COVID and to a much greater degree than they are now. And so they wouldn't be wanting to go to the polls in person. So, almost no one voted at the same early vote by mail rates they did in 2020.
And this is why I assume that it's so important in polling to poll likely voters and to determine who likely voters are. You know, when I go out, I was a political direct mail consultant. So when I wanted to mail into a particular area, we looked for likely voters. Those were the people we looked for first. They were those are the people we wanted to persuade. So we would look at voting records we could get from the Board of Elections. We couldn't see who you voted for, but we could see how many times you voted. So if you were somebody that voted in the last four primary elections, for example, we would consider you a potential likely voter. Is that still how we do it? Do we do it by looking at past voting for behavior, or are there other predictors, or do you ask people how likely they are to vote? Do you try to gauge that somehow?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, and I think the answer is different pollsters do it different ways. Because you do definitely want to ask people. You might choose your voter base by targeting individuals from voter files instead of just doing random sampling. And I think for campaigns, there's a shift now, too, because there definitely are persuadable voters. I think people exaggerate their depth. I mean, we saw a lot of swing voting in this election, but turnout there's a lot less of them than there used to be. Most people are pretty dyed-in-the-wool Democrats or Republicans, especially in Senate races or federal races. And so, you're probably more focused on the person that turned out in 2020 that is 18, was 18 then, is now 20, and you really don't know if they're going to vote again. Or maybe they voted, one of the last three midterms, and it's a midterm. And so if you engage them, you might be able to get them out there. When without that, there's under 50% chance.
In reading about, in reading some information about recent polling, I came across a thing that said that polls are subject to certain errors due to random variation. What's random variation? Do you understand what they mean by that? Because that threw me. I didn't understand what that meant.
Yeah, I think that's just a fancy way of saying they could be wrong because of things we're not expecting. And this isn't an exact science. So we can't tell you in which way they're going to be wrong. We can just tell you that sometimes they're going to be wrong, and we're going to be wrong by about this much on average. So have a healthy dose of skepticism to translate it into English.
And what about that? What about the fact that we're trained in this country, probably all over the world, as children to think of mathematics, anything that includes numbers, as being a fact, factual, right? Science is more factual than the other disciplines. What do you think about that? Do you think that we rely more on polls because we think if we see a number that makes it, more believable that we think, if you use numbers, you sound more correct. Do you think that's one of the things about polling that makes it so important to people?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's something to be said. Look, it's far from perfect to get at the heart of what you're saying. And I think the real key is just remember healthy doses of skepticism. These numbers tell us where the race probably is, but the random variance, it's this could be in either direction. We can probably come up with a few reasons about why it could miss in each one. We don't know what's actually going to happen for sure, but this is along the lines of what we can expect. Now in terms of the numbers being more valuable, there is something to that in that, it's not always going to be right, but these days we mostly know people that think the same way that we do, right? There's lots of exceptions out there, but for most Americans, the majority of people that live near them and the majority of their friends and often the majority of their family is going to vote similarly. And that's because, along all these different groups that were polarized along. If you live around people that have similar levels of education or race, or you're of course going to live near people that live in similar regions just by very nature of living, right? They're going to think similarly. That's honestly a big part of why I started my election forecast. I was in New York City, and I could tell that the people I was around were not representative at all, and it was hurting my political compass, and I really wanted to know what was happening, and I just built my own thing to be able to figure out what, using some of the polling data, what was actually going on.
Well, and that was my problem. That was my problem, is that, you know, and I had friends, and I just didn't believe them, who were lived in places like Arizona, who were saying to me, you don't understand. You live in a bubble there in Washington, D.C., and of course all the liberals that you associate with are not going to vote for Donald Trump, and everybody you talk to is not going to vote for Donald Trump, but you're out of touch because you're not out. You know, I'm in Arizona, and I can tell you, people don't feel the same way they do in Washington, D.C. And that's been a problem for the Democratic Party, I think, is that we've lost touch with middle America in a lot of ways. Do you think polling's had any, and should take any of the blame for that? Do you think that, you know, that we see what we want to see in polls and that reinforces the way we believe?
Yeah, I think if you are reading, it probably depends where you're getting your numbers from. If you're just looking at all the polls, I think it can be kind of an aesthetic for that almost that can prevent that problem. If you're looking at polls from, like, let's say what MSNBC is going to be covering, they're going to be doing a lot more cheerleading polls about how this is good news, because that's what the viewership would want to hear, and right, they don't want their viewers to tune out by just saying, oh, it looks like we're heading towards disaster. So to some degree, you know, the news organizations, in the way that they have bias, will show the polls that are better or worse for their side. But I think they can help show us that, hey, this person that I think is great may not be doing so well. Look, my priors going into that Georgia Senate race were that Herschel Walker, who had, you know, frequently threatened to kill his wife over and over and over again, was going to lose by like 5, 6, 7%. It was clear for me from the polling data that I was wrong about that, and I had to change. If I had no polling, I certainly would have expected it would have been a clean, easy win for Warnock in the first round.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that. Let's talk about Georgia. Is there anything, have we been doing polling already post-election on how people feel in Georgia? And I'm sure there'll be a gazillion polls done between now and the beginning of December. It's only a few weeks until the next election. Have we been doing polling, and what does your polling show in Georgia? What is your analysis of that polling?
So that's a great question. The last few days have actually been really hard at work. I just launched my Georgia Senate forecast at racetothewh.com/Georgia. So what I think going into this is that Warnock is favored, but it is not a slam dunk. I give him a 72% chance of winning the election, with expecting about a 2.5-point win, but it's very clear that Warnock can win this too. So we are dealing with incredibly limited polling, because the only polls we have so far, unfortunately, are polls done before the election. So those were kind of assuming the same voter base would turn out. So some of these people will not turn out, and the polls will help us get a better idea if those are Warnock or Walker supporters that are less likely to turn out in the second round. But the only two polls we have, when you put them in a polling average, have Warnock up by 0.2% over Walker, 48.2 to 48. But I think we need a lot more polls to get a better idea of what's really going on.
Yeah, and how do you calculate for things like, there's been speculation that Republicans may not show up as strongly because they won the House of Representatives. So they may not think it's, you know, there's all this speculation, of course, going on. But that's one thing I've heard more than once, that there are people saying, well, you know, Republicans may not show up in as great a number because they think they've already won. They've won the House of Representatives, and that's what's important. And they've lost the Senate. Right. They understand the importance of control of the Senate. And regardless of the outcome of the race, they have lost the they have lost the Senate, and they understand that. How do you control for those kind of factors, and can you control for that in Poland?
I don't think in that specific way I can, per se, in that I don't know at this point. Well, partly because I don't actually have polling yet since post-election, but without the polling, sorry, I should say. I can tell which would be stronger between Republicans who now know, okay, it's not a play, the Democrats who are feeling pretty good because this went a lot better, and Republicans who are mad that, hey, we thought we were going to have this big red wave, it didn't happen, what the heck. However, I will say the one thing, this is kind of like a qualitative quantitative combo, right? It's not my model, but it's something I'm watching, and to me makes me think Warnock is modestly favored. If you look at the exit polls, and mind you that these exit polls were about 2 points to the right of the actual outcome, so this is a little bit more favorable to Walker than the reality was. And you ask people, does Herschel Walker have good or poor judgment? 63% said he had poor judgment, 34% said he had a good judgment, the rest didn't answer, right? Among the people that said Herschel Walker has poor judgment, 24% of them actually voted for Herschel Walker. So those are reluctant, in my view, reluctant Walker voters. And they're ones who were already there. They were probably going there mainly for Kemp or for other reasons. Maybe, right? Maybe in the end they're going to be like, I want this Republican senator enough, I'm going to do it again. And I'm sure most of them will. But if there's a certain number of those who are like, I was just here because I had to vote for someone, but I don't like Walker enough to actually go out and vote when he's the only guy on the ballot, that would give things a little bit more in Warnock's favor. And I think there's a lot of them. He really disconcerted a lot of partisan Republicans. And so I just don't know. Even if you have 5% lower turnout than you would otherwise have in this types of election, that could easily throw things in Warnock's favor.
Right. And it could go the opposite way too, right? It could be, you could say equally the same thing about Democrats. Maybe Democrats won't show up because they feel like they already won the Senate and it's really not going to make a difference in who controls the Senate. But it seems to me, if I had to fall back on a reason for that, I would say I would rely on the old caveat that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. They seem to support whoever the candidate is, regardless sometimes about how they feel about the issues, whereas Democrats always seem to care about the issues. So no great predictions in Georgia. Do you think that, you're making a prediction, but no extensive polling being done in Georgia at this point. But will that change over the next week? You think a lot of people will rush in there all of a sudden and start to poll?
I hope so. I'm a little nervous. In 2020, there was less of polling than I expected, even though the whole country's political future kind of depended on it. Maybe that's a little dramatic. The future of the Senate, anyway, depended on it. And I think only like 7 or 8 came out. And these days, pollsters, there's less pollsters doing this. I think newspapers are less willing to pay for public polls because, they don't want to look bad if it goes wrong. Maybe that changed when the polling was a little better, but I'm sure we'll at least see 3 or 4. Probably one's going to come out this week. I'm surprised we haven't seen any, to be honest, but maybe that's because a lot of these pollsters, they set up their vacation for their long work, when it's finally over. They're gone for a month, and some of them might scramble it, that we're getting closer to December at the end, but we'll see. Yeah. If they're not starting to conduct their polls now, people don't tend to do polls over Thanksgiving, so we might be getting a few in the last few days of December, in the last few days of the election, if they aren't doing it this week.
Well, that's true, and we all did. I was a political consultant for 25 years, and I was a direct mail consultant, so that's why I did a lot of campaign work. In my life, I've worked on a lot of presidential campaigns because my work was always done 6 weeks before the election or 4 weeks before the election. If you hadn't mailed a month before the election, because I did mostly fundraising mail, there was no sense in mailing. So that's what we would do. We would plan the last month of the election to actually go out and knock on doors and phone bank and, do the kind of regular shoe leather thing, as we call it in politics, that politicians usually do. Well, we're running out of time here. So let me ask you, is there anything that I haven't asked you, something important that you want to say about looking at these polls and predicting the future that we haven't covered?
Yeah, I would say that this isn't a deep philosophical thing. I think it's just an interesting story that some people haven't been catching up on. There was an enormous ground-shaking shift for Donald Trump that, okay, stop me if you've heard these words before. I know you have many times, usually probably not said to the degree I just said it. But this time the data shows Donald Trump isn't actually losing a lot of support in a way that I haven't seen before after January 6th or any point since he's been president. In a lot of primary polls for 2024, his support drops by 25% in both state and national polls. Even the best polls for him show him a lot lower. He's now below 50%. Some show him as low as 35%. So I think that there's always this theory that we never really knew was true, and I guess we don't know for sure yet, but that if Donald Trump was seen as less of a winner, that would hurt his brand because that's a lot of his identity. It's kind of happening now because people blame the GOP or having some of the conversations they didn't have in 2020 about maybe this isn't the best route forward for us as a party. And, you know, they're blaming him for this 2020 and 2018 now. Some people are. So there's a real possibility the party is going to go in a different direction. In theory, the most likely is DeSantis, but you never know. You know, Rudy Giuliani led every single poll, almost every single national poll in 2008 for the GOP primary, and he started falling apart 2 weeks before Iowa, and he only won one delegate. So you never know, right? The guy who hasn't run before doesn't always look as good once he's in the ring. But I would say that's something to keep an eye on, because that is a dramatic change in the future of our country if Trump ends up not being the nominee, despite his attempts to run again.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing to point out there is that the primary process is so much different than the general election process, you know, and that's really the thing. Well, I agree. I don't think he can win at this point, and I think that'll drive people away from him. But will that be enough to keep him out of the primary, keep him from succeeding in the primary, given the core group that he's got pulling for him? And I want to make my first prediction for 2024, and that is that Rudolph Giuliani will not be the nominee of the Republican Party. But I want to thank you can go on record with that one. I want to thank you, Logan Phillips, editor-in-chief of Race to the White House, a website which breaks down the strategy driving campaigns and analyzes political battleground using sophisticated data-driven analytics. We will keep an eye on you and your prediction, and I hope we can have you back on the show sometime. And thank you so much for taking the time to be with me tonight.
Hey, it was an absolute pleasure. Happy to be back anytime.
Yeah, and we dedicate a song to our listeners and our guests. And this goes out to Logan Phillips and all those Democrats out there that are feeling it right now because we seem to be doing well. Here's a classic one from the Beatles. We'll see you next week. Thanks again, Logan. Best of luck to you in the future. Let's have you back after the elections or after Georgia maybe and talk about what happened. Okay, thanks again.
Thanks so much.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.